Okay, so we're going to do a quick introduction now in general to our classes here at Mechon Meir. We have class on Sunday from 7 to 7:45. That class... We didn't get that class. We're starting this coming Sunday. That class is still to be discussed. I'm hoping we're going to do in that class Medrash and stories from the Talmud. Our class Sunday evening will run from, I think we're going to move it earlier to 8:30. Right now they're starting 8:45. I think we're going to start 8:30 and run till 10. If we start earlier, we could end earlier. And that class, we do Nach, we do Navi. And I think we're going to continue where we left off in the book of Malachim. And then we do Binyan HaBayit about the Jewish home. I'll get to you, David, and then... our next class is on Wednesday evenings, tonight, between 7 and 7:45. There's a sign-up sheet. I meet with the guys 15-minute slots. We could do whatever you want. We could discuss whatever you want. We could learn whatever you want. And then our next class is Wednesday night, what we have now, and that's the Parsha class. The goal of this class is to cover the Parsha so that every mitzvah in the Parsha is covered. We won't be able to cover every aspect, but every mitzvah, my goal is that if someone goes through a series learning, he'll have covered all of the Torah, he'll be familiar with the general concepts of the mitzvahs, and if you go through a whole series, hopefully you'll also be familiar with general philosophical concepts in Judaism. There's a constant doubt in my mind, and that's something we're going to discuss in a minute, on what level to give the class. Certain years we give it on a very high level, where we incorporate many different opinions. Other years we give it on a base level where it's what the average child would learn on the Parsha, which I think is very, very important. Ideally, I would want the class to begin with the assumption that everyone has gone through the Parsha with Rashi, and the question is if we could think on that, and that's what we're going to discuss in a minute. If I know that all of you have familiarized yourself with the Parsha with Rashi, then we could start on a higher level. If I know that you don't know Rashi, then I have to make sure to cover Rashi and everything else. My preference is that this class does not refer to sources. That we just go through the parasha and mention the concepts and the ideas without referring to sources, because it flows much better that way. Last year we had numerous requests from our listeners on the web and from guys in the class to mention when we're quoting a Ramban, when we're quoting a Chizkunim, when we're quoting the Rambam, etc. Guys posted complaints with me and with your listening that they do want to hear the sources, so we changed the style last year. This year, I suggest we go back to the old style of just going through the Parsha without the sources, because I think it's tedious to hear what this one says and what that one says. Just hear it as a story and incorporate the concepts as we go through it. I'm waiting if people will protest after we do it for a few weeks. If I get enough requests, we'll switch to the other style. And now the question is posed back to you. How many of you will be able to cover the Parsha with Rashi before they come to this class?
The whole Parsha?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, one by one, maybe half.
Okay, fine. But if I know you'll cover the Rashi, then I could leave it. Because we have to know that the basic shot you have to know is Rashi. Everything else is additions. It's nice. It's enriching. But Rashi is most important. Everything else is secondary. Rashi is what your children will come home with, and Rashi is what the average person on the street knows. So Wednesday nights, Bezrat Hashem, we'll be doing the Parsha, and being that I see most people will be doing Rashi, I'm going to try to skip Rashi and just mention it like in passing. I'll get you, David, I didn't forget. Thursday nights, every other week we have class. We try to go as late as you guys have strength. Usually it runs till about 2 a.m. 1 week yes, 1 week no. This week we're supposed to have a class. You could go to whenever you have strength.
Yeah. After 10 hours.
We have people leave at 10, we have people leave at 11, we have people leave at 12. We try to bring in pizza at about 11:15, 11:30. Sometime then comes in pizza and other refreshments. We have refreshments throughout the night.
It's every day like that?
It's every other Thursday. This week, because it's the beginning of the year, we're hoping to have a class. It won't run too late. Next week we're going to have a special class, and Bezrat Hashem we're going to be having a trip at the Kotel, and at the Kotel we'll have our class. This week I don't know yet if I'm going to be able to make it. Look at the sign up, look at the bulletin board, and you'll see. I hope to have a class tomorrow night. On Thursday night's class, we do a lot of things. We do Tehillim, we do Mishle. We're almost finished with Shmona Prakim, the Rambam's introduction to Pirkei Avos, and then we'll continue to learn the Rambam on Pirkei Avos. We do Medrash Pirkei Rav Eliezer. We have an open session question and answer where you could ask any question you want, and we discuss it, and sometimes that takes the whole night. We learn Jewish songs, and then we do things that fit the time. Now we're going to try to get a start on Koheles in preparation for Sukkot, etc. Friday morning, there's a sign-up sheet, and people could sign up. We meet again for 15-minute slots, and we could learn whatever you want, we could discuss whatever you want. Then there's a class. We finished the Rambam's 13 principles, and now we are in the middle of the Rambam's letter to the Jews in Yemen. Everyone is welcome to join. Even if you haven't heard the previous classes, you could still join because we're starting a new topic. So anyone can join. We do the Rambam's letter to the people of Yemen. We do 5 minutes trying to cover the 5 to 10 mitzvos out of the 613 mitzvos. Our goal is within a year to finish all 613. And what else do we do Friday morning? Remind me. We do one other thing, I forgot what. What else do we do Friday morning? No. Aside from that. And we do halacha, right? We do halacha Friday morning. We try to cover a topic, meaning we'll take the laws of mezuzah and try to cover all the laws of mezuzah on one Friday morning. The laws of yichud, all laws of yichud one Friday morning. We try to take each Friday, finish a topic from beginning to end. The laws of tvilas kelim from beginning to end.
Did you say the
what?
Did you mention mitzvah?
Yeah, interag mitzvah. Shabbat morning. Those of you who want to wake up early and go daven vasikin or daven at a 6:15 minyan. When I can, so we have after davening at my house, kiddush, voluntary, whoever wants shows up.
But once
we
here, you might get it wrong.
Prayer here is at 8. We start learning at 8:15. You can't, you pray here, you don't come to learn.
On Shabbat.
On Shabbat, it's 7:30, when's prayer? 7:30, 7:45, I don't know. I don't know exactly. I don't know. It's late. You can't, if you pray here, you can't come to learning. If you pray early, at a 6 o'clock minyan, then at my house we have learning Shabbat morning, and we learn a lot of things. We do Shabbat morning. What do? We do a little bit of Hasidut if David Gaber shows up. We do we do Maharal, Baragola. Sure, there's everything here. Aside from here, at my house, Shabbat morning, those who want can daven early and come. And then we have kiddush, we have cake or cookies or whatever, and we learn maharal, we learn a little bit pirush hatfila, understanding prayer, we learn a little bit kitzur shulchan aruch, a little bit halacha, and we do stories midrashim from the book by the Maria Buhav Menorat HaMaor. That's Shabbat morning. Now you have to check with me each week to see if we're going to do it or not. This week I don't think we're going to have a Shabbat morning class, but I don't know yet. I'll let you know on Friday. I just don't know. I have to see. Now, as most of you know, my wife, Baruch Hashem, is expecting, and my wife was hospitalized a few weeks ago, and now she's back home in bed rest, which means that I'm acting as mommy and daddy, and cleaner, and cook, and all the other things, Baruch Hashem. But it also means that I have a lot less time this month. So after class I have to leave. I could only speak to one person on the way home. Ordinarily I speak to guys usually after class a little bit, and now I'm just constricted in time. So the sign up sheets will hopefully be there, and then we can meet, but other than that, time's a little bit tight now, and that's why I don't know what's going to be Shabbos morning, but Bezat Hashem, I hope we'll get as much as we can out of it, and if guys let me know that they want to talk, so I mean, we could set up the time and we could talk on the walk home. That's where things are holding now, and I'm open to suggestions. The classes are basically fashioned according to what you request. Many of the classes were started based on your requests, so I want feedback. If you tell me what you want, I can fashion the classes in accordance with what you want. The classes as you see today are a result of what previous students wanted, and things are dynamic. Our goal in all our classes is to cover as much information as possible. And I want you to know two things. On the one hand, it's enticing. It seems like, wow, we're going to cover the whole parsha and many, many things on the parsha. On the other hand, you have to know that as important as this class is, The other classes have an element where they're more important, because a person's observant, a person's observance is contingent on two factors. You have to know what the mitzvot are. You can't observe if you don't know the mitzvot. But more importantly, you have to develop a want and a connection with the mitzvot that will cause you to want to observe them. And of the two, the desire is more important than the knowledge, because if you have the desire, you gain the knowledge. And if you have the knowledge and you don't have the desire, then you won't gain the knowledge. Then the knowledge will end when you leave the machon. And that's why the other classes work on emunah and hashkafa, and those are more important. This class works on getting you knowledge. We cover a lot of ground. We try to cover a lot of concepts in Judaism. And if you attend the classes, you'll see we try to cover a lot of ground. Each class tries to cover a lot. But at the same time, weigh it. Though that's a basic overview of the classes. David, yeah.
We are finding out about the Shaktin class. Did you talk about that? Seems like everybody tells about who Shaktin.
Yes, I spoke to Rav Gad about it, and he said he will be happy to give us a class and take us to see the slaughtering of an animal. We just have to arrange it. He approved it. He said he'll be happy to do it. I spoke to him about it, and it just disappeared because I was gone. I was out of commission for the last few weeks. But just before I was taken out of commission, I told you I talked to him. I spoke to him. He said he'll be happy to do it. We just have to arrange it now. He'll give us a class over an animal. He'll bring an animal, and then he'll show us everything he does with the animal and explain.
Oh, did he do it live?
Live, yeah. So we just have to arrange it. We have the potential's there. He was talking about a goat. We could do a chicken. Okay, so just remind me. Remind me, and we'll try to arrange it. I don't know. We have to talk to him. I didn't get the details. I just want to ask one more thing. If we use any term that you don't know, ask. Don't be embarrassed. I'd rather you ask. I try to translate all the terminology I use, but sometimes I forget myself. So ask. And now we're going to begin. We are recording, and our recordings go up onto the web usually an hour after the class is given. We have listeners. We have more listeners than we have people in the class. But our focus is you guys. The listeners are secondary. You guys are here. You guys come first. Any question you have, anything you want, you can ask. And as much as we can, we try to deal with it. Sometimes we say that has to wait for a Thursday night, and then we can expand on it. Thursday night is when we expand on all the other side things. What?
We never thought about it again.
That's up to you. The beginning of last year, the guys got together, they brought a notebook, and every time we said that's for Thursday night, they wrote it down in the notebook, and they showed up to class Thursday night with a notebook. So that's in your hands. That's up to you. And now we'll begin our Pasha class. The way we do the Parsha class is we first do a quick overview of the Parsha, and then we review it with more depth. Tonight, being that it's the first class of the semester, we have to introduce everything, and so we're not going to begin that way. We're going to begin with a more general introduction. And the first thing we have to introduce is what are we studying here? I mean, this is the Torah, right? So, what is the Torah? And that seems like a funny question. So, being I see the heads drooping, I challenge you to define the word Torah. It's not so simple what the word Torah means.
Something like law, instruction.
The divine law to live that people should live. Jews especially.
Okay. We see there's two Torahs, yeah?
So...
Maybe there's also a...
Some say even three Torahs.
So he's saying that there was a Torah before there was a Torah Misinai, written in black fire and white fire.
Okay, so let's quickly go over things. We have a very important concept called the Istakel Bo Raito Vara Alma. And now I'm going to run forward, and if I'm going too fast, slow me down. Whenever one is going to build something, it's good that one makes a plan. Our tradition has it that before God created the world, God wrote the Torah. God wrote the Torah, looked in the Torah, and according to the blueprint that's written in the Torah, God created the world. If the Torah describes that there are animals that chew their cud and animals that don't chew their cud, so God had to create a world where animals chew their cud and don't chew their cud. And if the Torah describes that there's kalim, that there's a concept of crossbreeding between animals or crossbreeding between plants, so then God created the world in a way that there's crossbreeding between animals and crossbreeding between plants. The Torah has within it all the secrets of the world and all the knowledge of the world. we don't know how to get that knowledge out. There's a story about the Ramban who had a disciple that left the Torah, and that disciple went and became a priest. He became big in the army, and then one day on Yom Kippur he sent a letter to the Ramban and he said, I want you to come before me. And the Ramban was forced to obey, and the Ramban came before this disciple named Avner, and the Ramban stood before him, and the disciple had something to discuss with him. He discussed it with him, and then he said, you know why I left Judaism? Because you once told us that every Jew appears in the song that Moshe Rabbeinu seals the Torah with, the song of Ha'azinu Hashemayim V'Adabeiru. That song, you said, every Jew appears in that song. And I said, well, if you can say that, you're speaking gibberish. And when I heard that, I left. And I challenge you to tell me where my name appears. So the Ramban went off to a corner, and he davened, and he came back and he quoted in the following verse. The pasuk says, "Amalti afehim ashbita me'enosh zicham." I said, God says, I've had enough with them. I will wipe them out from the remembrance of mankind. The Ramban told him, take the third letter in each word over there and you'll see your name spelled out. When God says, I will wipe them out from mankind, your name is spelled out over there, Avner. And when Avner saw that, Ach Ehem, the third letter, is Aleph. Ashbita, the third letter, is Beis. Me'enosh, the third letter, is Nun. Zicham, the third letter, is Resh. So the Ramban showed him that his name appears within those terrible words. And so, when Avner heard that, he said, okay, so God says he's going to banish me from the world. So Avner accepted upon himself to do tshuva, and he took a ship, and he went out to sea without oars, and he said, God, I'm accepting this punishment on me, take me back. And was never heard from again. That's an example. The Gra was once challenged, tell us where the Rambam's name appears in the Torah. So the Gra answered, it says, the man Revos Mofsai Beretz Mitzrayim. God says, I want to show many wondrous things in the land of Egypt. We all know the Rambam was in Egypt. Revos Mofsai Beretz Mitzrayim is Rashi Tevos Rambam. So if you'll ask me to find your name in the Torah, maybe if I daven, God will reveal it to me. Right now, I don't know. I don't know where my name is in the Torah. Well, I know where it shows up because it's spelled out, but beyond that I don't know. We know that the Torah encompasses all the wisdom of the world, and when we learn the Torah we have to be careful not to think of it as a law book, not to think of it as a guidebook, not to think of it as a history book. This is much more than that. It's all that and more. It's not here to write history, but by the way, it teaches us history. One of the wondrous things that Moshe Rabbeinu did for the Jewish people when he showed up was he recorded to them, hey, I'll tell you the way the world is created. I'll tell you the origination of every nation. And that's one of the things that the Torah does for us in the beginning of the Torah. But that's not the purpose of the Torah. Those are byproducts of the Torah. The Torah is a gift that God gave the Jewish people. And God gave it to us through His trusted servant Moshe Rabbeinu. Every letter in the Torah is valuable. Every word in the Torah is valuable. And we have to focus and learn how to learn from each letter and each word what the Torah is saying. And we have to value each letter and each word. Our sages were meticulous in taking care that we have a tradition on each and every letter in the Torah, how to pronounce it, when to pronounce it, and in what tune to pronounce it. These things we have from Sinai, and the meticulous care that has been taken over the generation has preserved it, as we know. And with that introduction, we are going to begin. There's more introduction that's necessary, but we're going to get it in our parsha. Our parsha happens to be a parsha that focuses on the rabbinics and the rabbis and their role in passing on the tradition, and that's part of what we need in our introduction, but we're going to get that from our parsha itself. And now a quick introduction to the book of Devarim. We've gone through the first four books of the Torah. We've learned in Bereishis what's known as Genesis, about the creation of the world, the 10 generations to Noah and the flood, 10 generations to Abraham, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. We start the Jewish people with the 12 tribes. The 12 tribes go down to Egypt. They go, and that's where the book of Bereishis ends. We're down in Egypt. We begin the book of Shmos. The Jewish people are placed in servitude. The Jewish people are turned into slaves in Egypt. We have the 10 Makos, the 10 plagues. The Jews leave Mitzrayim and start getting mitzvos. They stand at Sinai. They err. They sin with the Egel, the golden calf. They have the commandment to build the tabernacle, the Mishkan. And that brings us to the end of the book of Shmos. We begin the book of Vayikra, and we have a description of the sacrifices that are to be brought inside the Mishkan and the mitzvos of the Kohanim. And we run through the book of Vayikra, learning the laws of purity, the laws of family purity, the laws of Tzaras, and all the mitzvahs of how to run a pure family. And we end the laws of Kohanim and purity in the Jewish people, and we end the book of Vayikra. We begin the book of Bamidbar, and we encounter the sinning of the Jewish people with the spies and the decree that they'll spend 40 years in the desert and the mutiny of Korah. And after we learn all the stories of the death of Aaron, the death of Miriam, the laws that are given in Bamidbar, we find ourselves encamped near Moabite territory. The Jewish people sin with the Moabite Midianite women. We have a war with the Midianites. We end the book of the Midbar, and we're encamped ready to enter the land of Israel. We're at the end of the 40 years. We're about to enter the land of Israel, and Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to enter. Aaron has passed away. Miriam has passed away. And now, in the last 36 days of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, he's giving us this speech of the book of Devar. And where we are situated is the Parsha of Shoftim. After we have learned in Parsha Sre'ei about the kosher animals and non-kosher animals, and basically what Moshe Rabbeinu is doing now in this last book is reviewing what he has said in the first four books, and now Moshe Rabbeinu is not only reviewing, but he's adding aspects to the mitzvahs that were not specified earlier. After reviewing the laws of the three regalim, the festivals, we are entering our Parsha, and now we will quickly do an overview of our Parsha. Our parsha is called Shoftim, Judges. Our parsha begins with the commandments of establishing courts and policemen and the responsibility to have a just court and that we should seek out justice. We have the commandment not to plant any trees on Har Abayis, relevant till today. We have a commandment that if we discover that there's a Jew who has gone for idol worship, then we have to take him to task for it. We can't turn a blind eye. He gets the death penalty. What happens if the courts in our towns don't know the answer to certain questions? So then there's a high court in a special place. The Torah doesn't identify the place. We know it ultimately became Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. And we go to that high court and they give ruling, and whatever their ruling is, we have to abide by that ruling. If anyone goes against that ruling, then they can end up getting the death penalty. And this teaches us that the Torah wanted a central ruling within the Jewish people, and the Torah also wanted that the Torah be defined by the rabbis. We're going to have to define that better, but we're doing a quick overview, and we're holding by Sheni. The Torah tells us what happens when we come to the land of Israel, and suddenly we say, we want to be like the other nations, we want to have a king. God says, okay, you can have a king, but he has to be limited. He can't be like the kings of the nations. He can't have too many horses, too many wives, too much wealth. He has to be focused on keeping the Torah. He has to write himself a special Torah that goes with him everywhere. It's like an amulet. He carries it with him wherever he goes. And this is to help him be a God-fearing person, and his responsibility is to ensure the keeping of the Torah within the Jewish people, and we're holding by Shlishi. The Torah reinstates the mitzvah that the Kohanim and Levim do not have a section in the land of Israel, and their job is to be the servants of God, the teachers of the Torah, and that's why whenever we discuss going to the high teacher and going to Jerusalem learning the Torah, we discuss the Kohanim and the Levim, ki sifteh chayin yishmul dat. The Kohanim are responsible to maintain the knowledge of the Torah within the Jewish people. The idea was that the Kohanim and the Levim will not be working the land. They're going to get the freebie. They're going to get the Truma, the Maestros, so the 24 gifts that the Kohanim get and the other gifts that the Levim get. The Torah says they're getting free support. They're on welfare, so to speak, so that they can maintain learning Torah and teaching Torah to the Jewish people. We're holding by Ravi. The Torah tells us that we have to be careful not to learn from the nations. We're going to come to the land of Israel and they're going to have all kinds of superstitions. We're going to see that they pass their sons and daughters through fire. Whenever a baby is born, the first thing they do is they take a flame and pass it over his head, and they say that's what's going to keep him healthy. They have all kinds of witchcraft and sorcery, and they speak to the dead, all kinds of things like that. God says, I hate that. Because of that, I'm kicking them out of the land of Israel. You can't be that way. You have to be complete with God. You're full focus. The only one that you want to run your life is God, and not look out for these other things. We're holding by Chamishi. These nations, they go to their magicians, and you not so, God says. I establish few prophets. I will establish a prophet like me, Moshe Rabbeinu says. We have to ask what prophet was ever like Moshe, so we'll have to discuss that, and you have to listen to him. The Jewish people had told God at Sinai, we can't handle God speaking to us directly, we need a go-between, and God says, it's good that they're so God-fearing, and therefore I will establish for them a prophet, and that's the job of the prophet. Navi comes from the word Niv Svatayim. Niv means speech. Navi is the one that speaks the word of God to the people. We have to listen to the Navi, and on the other hand, what happens if there's a false prophet? How do we know? If the prophet tells us, you know, tomorrow it's going to rain, and tomorrow it doesn't rain, then he gets a death penalty. Prophet can't mess up. God says something's going to happen, it's going to happen, and we will discuss this greater detail later. We have the commandment of making cities of refuge. If someone kills someone mistakenly, then he has to run to the city of refuge, and details of that we'll discuss later. If someone tries to murder someone else and then say it was a mistake, so we're not supposed to let him get away with running to the cities of refuge. The Torah tells us we're not allowed to take the boundaries between our fields and move it over a little bit. That's a form of thievery, and from here our sages derive that there are limits on commerce as well. I can't live in this town and go to your town and open a pizza shop next to your pizza shop. From this pasuk that I'm not allowed to expand my boundary, just move the fence between us so that I get more land, we also derive laws of commerce that there are fair practices of competition and unfair practices. The third.
I'm sorry, but isn't in everywhere in Jerusalem kosher thing?
Okay, so all the details we won't be able to answer in this class, but a little bit, so we know the concept exists, so we know when to ask questions from the rabbi. The Torah tells us what happens if witnesses walk in and say so and so did such and such an act and he deserves this punishment. We warned him, and as we're about to execute the punishment, after we've accepted their testimony and we're about to fulfill the punishment, two witnesses walk in and say, you were with us at the time that you claim you saw this crime occur. So then they are called Edim Zomimim, and they get the punishment they wanted to inflict upon the other person. When we go to war, then we have a special Kohen, and he gives a speech to the people. He tells them, don't be scared. You should know that God is the one that's leading the war. And they give a speech. They say, you know what? If someone built a new house, and he hasn't yet had time to live in it a year, he goes back home. If he just planted a vineyard, and he didn't get to enjoy it yet, he should go back home. If he just got engaged, and he hasn't yet been married and lived with his wife, let him go back home, lest one of these people die at war, and then they'll never be able to reap the crop that they've just harvested. The people tell him, and if anyone's scared, let him go home. And this is speaking about a war that's a voluntary war. There are different levels of war within the Jewish people. If there's a war where we're all threatened, no one can say, I'm going home. Everyone has to go fight a war. This is speaking about a specific type of war, which is called the Milchemes Rishus, and maybe we'll get to discuss
what's
that.
Called in
English? Voluntary war.
When the Torah speaks about everybody.
Milchemet Chovan, an obligatory war. We're holding by Shvi. When we go to attack a city, the Torah says we have to first offer them peace. And if they want to make peace, so then we make peace with them and they become subservient and they pay taxes and they accept the seven Noahide laws. Does this apply to the seven nations in the land of Israel or not?
No.
Different opinions among the Rishonim. Some say yes, some say no.
Technically the seven nations of the land was supposed to be destroyed.
They were supposed to be destroyed, but the question is...
went away to Africa.
When we review it, we'll try to discuss it with more depth. When we go to attack a city, so the Torah tells us that lo tashchit et etzah, don't destroy its fruit-bearing trees for nothing. And from here we have the source of the mitzvah of Baal Tashchus. We're not allowed to be destructive in the actions that we do. If a person has... So we apply it to many things. You're not allowed to be destructive if there isn't gain from it. And here the Torah tells us a very important concept. Ki adam et hasadeh. Man is the tree of the ground, and this has great Kabbalistic implications. What does it mean? Man is a tree. Sometimes we treat the tree as a man, and a man as a tree. And what that means, I don't know if we'll ever get to discuss. And the parsha ends with what happens if a person is found murdered, and we don't know who killed him, so we try to find out. We can't verify, so the Torah says we have a whole procession called Negla Rufa. We bring out elders from Jerusalem. After we've done all the detective work and we couldn't find out any information on who murdered this person, so we bring the elders of the city and we start measuring which city is closest to that city, closest to the corpse. And then they have to bring a special calf, and they hack the calf from the neck. They kill it. And we bring in elders from Jerusalem and we say a special thing. We say, God, our hands are clean. We didn't murder this person. And that place where the calf's blood is spilled is never planted. It's never harvested. What's the whole idea of this procession? The idea is you're doing something very unusual. You're bringing in elders. You're measuring. All the elders are going out. You're saying special words. Everyone's going to come out and see it, right? Everyone's going to come out and see it. There's going to be more people are going to talk about, hey, there was a murder out there. And then maybe when we do this whole procession, people will talk about it more and we'll get more information. We'll be able to catch the murderer. And God says, don't let blood be spilled plainly. If a person was murdered, even though no one knows who murdered him and we don't know anything, we have to stop and say, wait, there's a special procession that has to take place here. We have to verify how this person was murdered. We can't just turn a blind eye. And that, and with that, we end the parasha of Shoftim. And now let's review the parasha with a little bit more depth. One of the fundamental concepts in the Torah is peace. The word shalom. Shalom comes from the word shalem, whole. We know the Torah is described as the racheha darchei noam, the ways of the Torah are supposed to be pleasant, v'chol netivoteha shalom, and all the paths of the Torah are supposed to lead us to peace. And when God created the world, God began creation with peace. Our sages tell us that before God created anything in creation, He asked it, do you want to be created? And the thing, whatever that means, if it wasn't created, who are we asking? So whatever that means, the angel that represents that creation, God asked him, how do you want to be created? You choose what shape, what form you want to be created in. And then God created them as mature beings. This is one of the answers to if we find dinosaurs, because we say that God created a mature world. God didn't create a new world. The Gemara already says, 2,000 years ago, right? The Gemara was written, that when God created the world, God created an older world. God created things mature. God didn't create a baby monkey. God created a mature monkey.
So that the millions and billions of years...
It could be right. It could be that, as far as science can tell, the earth is a million years old, because God created an old world. God might have wanted us to have fossil fuels. God wanted us to have petroleum. So God created the world in a way that if today we'd want to make petroleum, it would take 3 million years. But God created the world in an older world. But that's not the point we're headed for. That's just...
I don't know how much one day is in Hashem's...
It's also true. But God began created with Shamayim. And we know that Shamayim is a combination of Esh and Mayim. And in order to put fire and water together, they don't work so well together. You always have to separate. You want to cook something, you put it in a pot, you have the fire on bottom, you have the water on top, and you have the pot separating in between. To put fire and water together doesn't really work. That's what God did. God made peace between them. And that's what we say in prayer, and that it's a pasuk in Job, in Eov. Oseh shalom bimumav. God made peace in His heavens. What peace does God make in His heavens? So the first peace is the actual creation of the heavens. The Shamayim is a concept of peace. Shamayim, putting together Esh and Mayim, is a concept of peace. God Himself is called Shalom. As Gidon called Hashem, Hashem Shalom. And as we say, Shira Shirim Asher Li Shlomo, the Song of Songs to Shlomo. Who's Shlomo? Shlomo is God. God is called Shlomo. Shlomo means Melech Shah Shalom Shelo. The king that owns peace. Who owns peace? That's God. That's why God is called Shlomo. Shalom Shelo. His peace. He owns peace.
So,
I don't either.
The spiritual fire was...
The sages told us that heaven is... that Shamayim... I don't know that Shamayim is heaven. Whatever Shamayim is, it's a combination of Esh and Mayim. I don't know what that means. God calls the Jewish people Hashulamit, the whole one, the one that brings peace to the world. The Jewish people's job is to bring peace to the world. And God gave us a Torah, that the pathways of the Torah, the way of living a Torah life, is a way that's supposed to lead us to peace. And Torah is supposed to lead us to be shalem, peace, at whole, with our physical. As God says, you keep my Torah when God takes us out of Egypt. I'll keep all illness that I placed in Egypt, I'll keep it away from you. And shalem and whole in our nefesh. As we say, Torah Hashem Tmima, God's Torah is whole. Meshivat nefesh, it brings the soul back to its source, to where it's supposed to be. God made a treaty of peace with the Jewish people. And because peace is so important, we end our prayer with peace. We know that our prayer is corresponding to the sacrifices. And at the end of the sacrifices, we end with Shlamim, the sacrifice that represents peace in the world. And Shlomo HaMelech ended the Song of Songs with peace. Hayiti ve'enav kimotzet shalom. He also ended when he described the different times, right? The third chapter in Ecclesiastes and Koheles describes there's a time for this and a time for that. Et milchama, he ends up, there's a time for war. Ve'et shalom, and there is a time for peace. And from there we derive what we saw in our parsha, that even at a time of war, there's a time for peace. Even within war, there's a time for peace. We begin a war by first asking the people, do you want to make peace? Want to make peace? Good? Not. And God makes peace in heaven between the angels. Now angels, they don't have jealousy. They don't have hatred. And nonetheless, we say that God has to make peace between them. Certainly here on our earth, we have to strive for peace. And that's what our parsha is focused on. Our parsha is focused on peace. Our parsha is focused on leadership. Our parsha is focused on having a justice system. And in order to have peace, you need to have justice. If one person grabs something from someone else, there ain't going to be peace unless there's a justice system. And by having peace in the world, that's what sustains the world. Aaron, the Kohen, why did he get life? Because he brought peace to the world. When Aaron would walk down the street and he'd see a couple fighting, so he'd walk in and make peace between them. If he knew two people weren't getting along, he'd make peace between them. You'd think Aaron is the top leader. He's equal to Moshe. You're talking about top. Wait, he has to spend time dealing with squabbles between a husband and a wife? Yeah. When you're top, then you care about having peace by everyone. Aaron cared about peace, and that's why God gave him a blessing of life and peace, and that his children will bless the Jewish people with peace. As we know, Birchas Kohanim ends with the blessing of peace. Now, we know the Mishnah says in Avos, there are three things that the world stands on, right? Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omed. Al adin, al ha'emet, ve'al ha'shalom. Din, justice. That's a very important part of this world. No one likes going to court, but we need to have a court. Now, one of the Noahide laws is to have a court system. And in our parsha, God will call it Jewified, the mitzvah of having a court system. The Rambam explains to us that even though when we look at the mitzvahs, it seems that you have seven Noahide laws, and then they became a part of the 613 laws. Explains the Rambam, it didn't work that way. It's not that God did, like a Windows, copy-paste. He had seven Noahide laws, copy them, paste them, now they're just part of the 613. It doesn't work that way. Even though some of the mitzvot have identical aspects, once they became a mitzvah to the Jewish people, they had an intrinsic change. They are not the same mitzvah copied and pasted. They are a new mitzvah given to the Jewish people. And once they are part of the 613, they're totally new. And so in our parasha, just one second, in our parasha, what the Torah is doing is it's taking one of the Noahide laws, the mitzvah to have a justice system, and the Torah is applying it and saying, you Jewish people have a commandment, you establish a justice system within you. Now it's true, we've had other commandments regarding the justice system throughout the Torah, but the commandment to establish a judge and a jury, or a set of judges, not a jury, that's in our parsha. Until now, what we've seen about establishing a court was that Moshe's father-in-law saw, hey Moshe, you're not handling this alone, let me give you a word of advice, why don't you establish a court, they'll help you out. God approved, they established a court, but there was no commandment to establish it. Here the Torah is commanding us to have courts throughout the Jewish people. Yeah, remind me your name.
So 613 mitzvahs plus 7 or minus?
Good question. There are two opinions as to whether we have 613 plus 7 or 7 are part of the 613. If we have 613 plus 7, then it's gematria keter.
Two first times, and first one time and then two times. Is it also counted?
I didn't follow you.
No, because at first he said all of like boom, and he said all of the ten commandments in one saying.
That counts as only one.
Oh, okay.
What means Keter?
Keter is gematria 620.
Yeah, what means?
Keter is a crown. Keter Torah.
So it's not in a 613 mitzvahs plus 7?
Two opinions whether it's part of the 613 or not. Some say the 7 Noahide laws are part of the 7, some say they're external. Yeah. According to that opinion, we would have 6 times.
So I was thinking, you know, since it's a 7 mitzvahs for everybody, then also for Jews. Because.
Okay, so the Kuzari teaches us that just like a plant isn't a sophisticated rock. A rock is an inanimate object, and a plant is a living organism. And just like an animal is not a sophisticated plant, it's a totally different being. Mm-hmm. So you have a plant, which is living, but it's alive. An animal is a totally different being. We have domim, somech, chai, right? The plant, we define it not as alive, but rather as growing, and then you have chai, a live animal. And then you have midaber, the one that has the power of speech. So you could say, well, a Jew is just one kind of midaber. That's one understanding. Or you could say, no. Just like there's an intrinsic difference between a plant and a rock, and a plant and an animal and a human, so too there's an intrinsic difference between a person before he becomes Jewish and after he becomes Jewish. Intrinsically different. And by the same token, we're going to say that commandments as Noahide laws are intrinsically different than the commandments as part of the 613, which is where we started all this. Getting back to this commandment, so we have a commandment to establish court, and we have a commandment to establish policemen for the court to enforce that law. The Navi equates David with Yoav. It says they had a package deal. Yoav was a very powerful general, and David was a very wise king. David would rule and Yoav would enforce. David couldn't rule if Yoav wasn't enforcing. Yoav couldn't enforce if David wasn't ruling. It works when it goes in conjunction. There's an importance to having a police, and there's an importance to having a justice system. The Torah tells us, Shofetim v'shoterim Titen lecha, establish for you. What does it mean for you? So the Torah seems to attribute this whole justice system to Moshe. What's it, Moshe's? So our sages tell us there were three things that Moshe was willing to give up his life for. One was justice. When he saw an Egyptian beating a Jew, he said, I can't see that. He's killing him for nothing. What did he do? This Egyptian tried stealing this Jew's wife. Now the Jew realized what happened, so the Egyptian is beating him to death. Moshe stood up and killed the Egyptian. He risked his life in doing that. Pharaoh caught him, sent him to the executioner. He was almost killed. Miraculously, he made it out alive. So he was willing to give up his life for justice. The justice is named after him. That's why God says, Shoftim v'shoftim titen lecha, you Moshe. I name the justice system. This is like Moshe's court. The two other things, just by the way, are, who knows, the Torah. It's called Torat Moshe. Moshe gave up his life for Torah. And the Jewish people were called Moshe's nation. Okay. What types of courts do we have? As far as the Torah is concerned, a court could consist of one individual. The Torah tells us, Betzedek tishpot amitecha, judge your fellow citizen righteously, indicating that the Torah is speaking to an individual. Biblically, you could have a court composed of one person. The rabbis instituted that you must have a court minimum of three, and that's a small court of betin, a vediotot, and that's why the Mishnah instructs us, al tidan yechidi, don't judge alone. Even God doesn't judge alone. God brings his angels to confer with them. Today, let's say me and Avram have a squabble, so we can agree that we're going to... Mordechai?
Raphael.
I'll get it eventually. We can agree that Raphael, we trust Raphael. Whatever he says goes. And then Raphael is going to judge. And his judgment is binding. Meaning we can agree that so-and-so is going to give judgment. But ordinarily, when we have disagreement, we go to a court of three. A court of 23 is a Sanhedrin Ktana, a small Supreme Court, and they can give the death penalty. Court of 71 is the top court. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu was told, gather 70 elders. 70 plus 1, that's 71. Moshe was the head of the court. The head of our Supreme Court is the Nasi. The one just beneath him is the Av Bezdin. Even though we call him the head of the father of the Bezdin, he's really number 2. The top is the Nasi. And he's supposed to be in place of Moshe Rabbeinu. And then next to him, the following one, the second in command, is going to be the Av Bezdin. He sits to his right.
Yeah. Nasi right now is Shimon Peres.
No, that's a joke. We just use the term Nasi. Today it's a borrowed term. It has nothing to do with it.
So there's two Nasis in the government right now.
Sorry, Shimon Peres doesn't know the first thing about the Torah. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying. Yeah. So we have two Nasis. One is the phone.
Today we don't have this. This is the way it was in the time of the Mishnah. Today we don't have it. God tells us, you do justice there, I won't do justice in heavens. I'll be compassionate in heaven. If you don't have a good justice system down here, I'll apply justice in heavens. So when we do din down here, then God does rachamim in heaven. The Torah tells us to make mishpat tzedek, a judgment.
Could you say that again for me, please?
Sure. God says, you do din ba'aretz, and I'll do rachamim b'shamayim. You don't have din ba'aretz, I'll do din b'shamayim. That's what God says. The Torah commands us to have mishpat tzedek, a righteous judgment. And this teaches us perspective. Sometimes we go to court and the court rules, I got to pay out 2,000 shekel. So I walk away and I'm upset. I'm going to have to pay 2,000 shekel. That's an incorrect perspective. Correct perspective has to be, look, maybe I shouldn't have these 2,000 shekel. If the court ruled that I owe it to him, then obviously I owe it to him. It's not good for me to have those 2,000 shekel. Our perspective is tainted with our prejudice, with our partiality. But if we would have a real perspective on the way things should run, then we would recognize that when the court rules that I have to pay 2,000 shekel, it's good for me and good for him. It's good for him, he's getting his money back. It's good for me because I shouldn't have that money. I owe him that money. And that's why it's called mishpat tzedek. They're really doing kindness to both of them in their ruling. The Torah warns us, do not tilt the judgment. The judgment has to be 100% right. There are 6 warnings in the beginning of our parsha. Corresponding to them, Shlomo HaMelech made 6 steps going up to his throne. He'd have an announcer standing in front of his throne. He'd step on the first step and the announcer would warn him, Lotate Mishpat, do not tilt the scales. Do not. You have to be just. He'd go up to the second step and he'd give him the second warning from our parsha, Lotakil Panim, don't recognize a person in injustice. He'd get to the third step, he'd get the third warning. Lo tikach shocha, don't accept a bride. The fourth step, lo titalach hashira, you're not allowed to plant a tree for idol worship. The fifth step, don't establish an altar for idols. And the sixth step, don't sacrifice to idols. What's the connection between idol worship and misjustice? Our sages tell us you establish an improper judge, it's the equivalent of establishing a place of worship for idols.
Because Hashem said not to do it.
There's probably a deeper connection
because,
than that.
Bad judges take bribes and they're dishonest and everything.
Okay. The word shochad comes from the word chad, singular. The second we accept the bribe, we become singular with the person we connect, and then it's very hard to see something wrong with him. Now, we would think, what's a bribe? You gave me $100, that's a bribe. The Gemara tells us that an Amora was trying to cross a river or something, and the other guy extended his hand and helped him cross. So after he crossed, he asked him, what do you want? He said, I need you to judge for me. He said, I can't, you just bribed me. That's a bribe? You help a guy cross the street? Yeah, that's a bribe. The Gemara tells us the story of Rav Hanan, that he had to cross a river. A guy gave him a guy came to bring Rav Hanan a basket of fruits, and Rav Hanan asked him, what do you want from me? So the man said, I have a court case, I need you to judge me. And Rav Hanan says, you disqualified me, you offered me the basket of fruits. Once you offered the basket of fruits, you showed that you have an affinity for me, I can't judge you anymore. So the man says, but take it anyways. Rav Hanan said, no. So he said, look, our sages teach us that if you give a rabbi a gift, it's as though you brought Bikurim, it's as though you brought your first fruit before God. So accept it, and then I'll be considered like I brought my first fruits before God. So Rav Hanan said, okay, I accept it. Now Rav Hanan used to have a charusa. Eliyahu used to appear and learn with Rav Hanan every evening. So Eliyahu Hanavi. And that's how we have Tanit Be'Eliyahu. So Rav Hanan sent him to someone else, to another rabbi. He said, please take care of this guy. So the guy goes with the defendant, and they go to this other rabbi, and he says, Rav Hanan sent me. Now this man thought for a second. He said, why would Rav Hanan send me word to judge this person? It must be that Rav Hanan, he's a friend of Rav Hanan's, and out of respect for Rav Hanan, I'll judge his case. I'll bump off a case of orphans. Always we give orphans precedence, but he must be an important person. I'll give him first dibs. I'll take his case first. When the other guy saw that this guy was getting such honor, his case was going before orphans, he said, I have no claim. That's it. I lost the case anyways. If this is how the judge is treating him, I don't stand a chance. What did Rav Hanan do? He did nothing wrong, right? He just sent word, please judge this person. Slightly wrong, right? He could have been slightly more careful. Eliyahu doesn't show up. That's it. Charus is over. So Rav Hanan starts fasting and davening. And finally, after a while, Eliyahu shows up and Rav Hanan can't look at him in the face. Rav Hanan has to sit in the box and Eliyahu teaches him from the box. Can't. That's it. He's not on the same level. That's the level we have to be careful from bribes. Even something small like saying, could you judge him without taking care that it might not be misconstrued? Rav Hanan was held to task. Now this also shows us the level we're supposed to show appreciation. The Torah tells us, don't hate the Mitzrim because you were a ger in their land. Imagine if the Torah said, you know those Germans, they put you in gas chambers, right? You owe them something. They were your hosts. Well, that's the same concept. The Mitzrim, I mean, they threw our babies into the Nile. They took our babies and put them in the walls instead of mortar. Why, we have to thank them because we were guests in their land? They were torturing us all the while. The Torah tells us, even on that level, there's an aspect where, bottom line, you lived in their land, you owe them something. And the Torah always trains us to learn to show appreciation beyond what we would think. If one knows to show appreciation, then that leads one to recognize God. It goes hand in hand. We'll continue. This is a concept we have to talk about at length, but we don't have time. The Torah tells us, tzedek tzedek tildo, seek out justice. Very often, if we have a court case, if we're the defendant or we're the prosecutor, we're looking for the judge where it'll work best for us. The Torah tells us, even as those involved in the case, we have to seek out justice. The Torah says the word tzedek twice, tzedek, tzedek, to teach us we have to be truthful in our speech and in our actions. Sometimes people say, I didn't cheat anyone. But when my boss asked me why I didn't show up to work, instead of telling him, you know, I overslept, so I tell him, you know, well, this emergency, that, that's slightly true. No, Torah tells us we have to be just in our words and in our actions. If we'll be just in our words, then we will really be just in our actions. And if we aren't just in our words, then we should know that it's not just our words. It's going to taint our actions as well. The Torah tells us, do not plant a tree of idol worship. And this is an instruction to the judge. The first thing as a judge he should look for are the overt problems within Jewish society. Sometimes we automatically look for things that are under the rug. We look for things that are hidden. People are going out on a shidduch and they're looking for all kinds of things. Maybe there's something with her great aunt. What about the girl herself? Maybe there's something wrong with the girl. And look at what's before your face. Before we look for something far out, we should look at the things that are overt, that are easy to see. So that's logical, but people don't always do that. There was once a mashgiach who started making an issue over a small issue, and a week later they discovered that there was pig's meat under his hashgacha. So when we're focused on looking for all kinds of things, sometimes we're missing the big picture. The Torah begins by telling the judge, look for the trees of idol worship. That's outside. Before you start looking for what people are doing inside their houses and hiding, first look for what's overt. We're continuing. The Torah tells us that we're not allowed to bring an animal as a sacrifice that has a blemish, and we're held to a higher level than non-Jews. Our animals have to be on a higher level of perfection. The Torah tells us if we have within our midst someone who is serving idols, then we have to take care of him. We can't turn a blind eye. And we have to take him out to court. And court is described as the court that's by our gates. Why were the courts always by the gates? To make it easier for a person to catch the defendant. If I have a claim against someone, so until I bring him to court, he's going to hang on, right? I go to court, he says, I'll be there tomorrow, I can make it, you know. People give you the runaround for a long time. That's why the courts were established at the city gates. No one could stay in the city forever. You go to the city gates, almost everyone leaves the gates every day. They used to have their fields outside the gates. If you have a claim against someone, you sit by the gates, the courts are there, and as he's leaving the gates, you catch him. You say, hey, so-and-so, I got to talk to you. That's why the courts are always described as being by the gates. When Boaz, in the Megillah of Rus and Ruth, wants to catch his relative and tell him, hey, we got to deal with Ruth, so he waits by the gates and he catches him that day. That's why the courts are by the gates at that time. Yeah?
Even before that, right, wasn't it also that Abraham, when he bought the Machpelah, that he was also sitting in the gates of Shem and Barak?
Very good. Excellent. You're right. And Lot also went to the city gates when he was judged. The Torah tells us that we take testimony from two or three witnesses, and this teaches us a concept in Halacha Trei Kimeya. Two witnesses are like 100. What does that mean? That means if 100 witnesses walk in here and say, on Sunday, Mr. Joe killed Mr. X. 100 witnesses. We say 100 witnesses is considered one testimony. If two witnesses walk in and say, on Sunday at that exact time, Mr. Joe was out in Uzbekistan, we say, okay, there's a contradiction. So both are disqualified. Let's wait and see if we get more information. What do you mean I had 100 men standing here telling you this? Yeah, well, if 100 men walk in together, we treat them as one testimony. This is a special halacha in Eidut, in testimony. In Eidut, we say, Trei Kemea, two are like 100. The Torah believed two just like it believed 100. It's one testimony. But it doesn't matter, the numbers. But when it comes to Ne'emanut, it's a totally different thing. Ne'emanut is not Eidut, it's two different things. Ne'emanut is, if I want to know if this food is kosher, so my wife tells me, here, eat. She's telling me it's kosher, I believe her. That's not Eidut, that's not testimony, that's Ne'emanut. When it comes to Ne'emanut, belief, so there I say there's a difference between 1 and 2 and 5 and 10, and there I listen to women, it's a totally different thing. When it comes to Eidut, in testimony we say Trei Kemea, two are like 100, there are special halachos about testimony. You guys with me?
Yes.
Okay. The Torah teaches us a very special din that the witnesses, when they testify that someone deserves the death penalty, they are the executioners. If you think about the psychological impacts of that, you got to put your money where your mouth is. You claim he deserves the death penalty. It's not someone else that's administering it. They're the ones that give the first shot. Yeah, that's tough. The Torah tells us what happens if we don't know what the halacha is, so we go to the high court and we have to listen to the high court. This is the source for the mitzvah that we have to listen to rabbinics. That we have rabbinic mitzvah. The rabbis instituted to light Hanukkah candles. Where did they get the power from? Here. The Torah says we have to listen to what they say, and this also gives them the ability to make rabbinic institutions. We wash our hands before we eat bread. That's our rabbinic institutions. We wash our hands before we go to pray. That's our rabbinic institution. We pray three times a day. That's our rabbinic institutions. Much of what we do during the day is rabbinic. We make a blessing before we eat. That's our rabbinic institution. We make a blessing after we eat, unless it's bread. That's our rabbinic institution. We make kiddush by day. That's our rabbinic institution. Right? So we have a lot of things that we do that are rabbinic, more things than we notice. Every time we do rabbinic mitzvah, says the Rambam, we are fulfilling two biblical mitzvot, because the Torah says, do as the rabbis say and do not transgress what they say. If so, we have to ask ourselves a question. Why is it that on biblical mitzvot, we say, when in doubt, be more stringent. And on rabbinic mitzvot, when in doubt, you can be more lenient. Why? Because when the rabbis instituted their mitzvot, they instituted this clause. They said, when in doubt, be more lenient. When it's a gzirah, when it's a certain kind of decree, so bimkom tzara lo gazu rabanan. They said we don't make our decree in situations where it's going to be extra painful. So we have to know the rules of when to apply it. But these leniencies were instituted as clauses within their institution to ensure that the institution would not be in effect in these cases. You guys with me?
Yes.
Yeah. Ronen? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
The Torah tells us that we have to go to the rabbis and ask them what the halach is. And this is one of the main sources of the answer to the people, and every generation had these people that said, I can understand the Torah just as well. The Torah says not that way. The Torah says there are going to be rabbis, they're going to have the tradition, there's going to be a high court, and they're going to be the ones that can tell you what the halach is. If the Torah was just up to how I understand it, how you understand it, how I want to modify it, how you want to modify it, then what do I need a high court for? We have here very often conservative and reform, what they call rabbis, walking in here to learn. They don't know anything. It's very funny. They walk to the classes like you guys. They know about as much as every guy that walks into Machon Meir. Maybe they've studied a little bit, so they have certain concepts. They know almost nothing. That's a rabbi. They can decide what mitzvah, how to interpret mitzvah. It's a shame. But every generation had them. We see that the Rishonim already point out that, hey, there are people walking around saying, I can interpret the Torah just as well. They don't have tradition. They haven't studied for many years. The Torah tells us not that way. In our parsha, the Torah says, you go up to the high court, and there's going to be people who have a stronger tradition, have studied for longer, and they're going to be the ones that are going to tell you how to interpret the Torah. Yeah?
Back to witness. The witness is also the one who has to blow the strike. I was thinking, am I obligated to, from a Torah point of view, if I'm seeing someone transgressing Shabbos, for example, am I obligated to? Because I don't want to.
That's a good question. I'd rather not answer it as a yes or no. Let's try and discuss it tomorrow night, okay? The Torah says you're going to want to establish a king like all the nations that are around you. And from here we derive a very important concept. Where's the international dateline?
Greenwich? No.
It's arbitrary. It's something which mankind has decided. At any given moment, there is a sunrise and a sunset somewhere in the world. So mankind has decided to place the dateline somewhere. The Torah tells us where to place the dateline. The Torah says the center of time is Israel, is Jerusalem. In our parsha, the Torah says, I will want to establish a king like all the nations that are around me. The world revolves around Jerusalem. You want to know where the day begins? It's in Jerusalem. And from here, you work out 12 hours each way, and you figure out the international dateline. Yeah. Now, this has a lot of halachic relevance. Think about it. Yeah. You're flying to Australia, and you want to know when Shabbos, when you cross international dateline. You want to fly out to Japan, flying from the U.S. to Japan, from Israel to Japan. When are you crossing the dateline? You want to go out to Alaska? I had a friend who was flying over Alaska on Tisha B'Av.
Oh, he's a kilometer.
And he needed to know when to start fasting, when to end fasting. He was flying out to Japan, I think.
Is it
for some reason they fly through there.
Good
question. We'll discuss it when we get there. In certain circumstances, yes. So this is how we figure out the international dateline. And this is what we mean when we say that Eben Shtiyah, that the stone at Har Abayis is the stone from which God began the creation of the world, and from there God created the world. And this is what we mean when we say that it's the highest place on earth. What do you mean it's the highest place on earth? Well, when you have a globe that's round, so what's the top of the round? Well, that depends on where in the galaxy you're looking at it from. So the Torah tells us your perspective has to be that the top is Jerusalem. The top is the Temple Mount. That's your perspective when you look at the globe. You could look at anywhere and say it's the top point. It's just a question of where you put the ball on top. What angle am I looking at it from? So that's our parasha. Our parasha says, you'll want say, I want to establish a king like the nations that are around me. Because the nations are around us, and that's why we say, Yerushalayim betoch ha-goyim, samtiha, usvivotea aratzot, the Navi says in Yechezkel. I placed Jerusalem among the nations, and all the lands I placed around Jerusalem, the Navi says in Yechezkel. The Pasuk says in Tehillim, kol goyim sivavuni. All nations, we said this morning in Hallel, surround me. What does it mean they all surround me? Because the way Judaism tells us to look at what is the international dateline is they all surround us. The day starts in Jerusalem. That's where the day begins.
In the
east. I'm taking a topic which we could discuss for a week and like opening it up in 2 minutes. There's more to discuss, obviously.
I'm sorry.
The Torah tells us we may establish a king, and then the question is, then why was God so upset at us that we did establish a king? Why did God say to the prophet, I gave you a king out of anger, and God also tells Shmuel on the spot, they're asking for a king, they don't want me. They've sinned in asking for a king, and God's very upset at them, Shmuel tells them. Why? Because God... Okay, so here there are a few understandings. One understanding is that there were two ways of asking for a king. You could say, I want a king because he will help us keep the Torah. Or you could say, I want to be a king, he'll help us win the wars, it will be like all the nations. The elders, we have a tradition, when they came before Shmuel, they said, we want a king because there's too much riffraff, there's too much improper behavior going on. If we have a king, then people will be behaving the way they should. But there was an overtone of Amei Haaretz who came along and said, we want a king to be like the nations. We want someone to lead us out to war. We don't want this direct connection with God. We go out to war and miraculously we win. We want everything to be organized. Can't be that one leader dies and then we're left hanging. There's no leadership in the Jewish people. There has to be a kingship. There has to be a dynasty. We have to be like all the nations. And that wasn't the way to ask for a king.
Dynasty. It's divided afterwards.
Divided, and our sages tell us that each king brought his own set of problems. King David brought a plague, King Saul brought us wars. Each king brought the problems with his kingship. God tells us
afterwards it divided.
That too. God tells us that you may place a king upon yourself. And the Torah stresses som tasim, place, you will place a king upon you. What does that mean? The Torah teaches us that we have to respect the king and honor him. One may not ride on a king's horse, sit in his place. Even if he forgoes his honor is not forwent. When he passes away, we burn all his clothing. No one else may wear his clothing, use his vessels. His wife is forbidden to marry anyone else when he passes away. When a king walks in, even the prophet has to stand in front of him and bow to him. We have to give him respect. And this teaches us something. The Mishnah says, "Aseh lecha rav," make for yourself a rabbi. And the commentators say, what does it mean, make for yourself a rabbi? If he knows more than you, if he's a rabbi, he's a rabbi. If he isn't, he isn't. What does it mean, make for yourself a rabbi? And many of the commentators say the same thing. You might be in a situation where you feel like, he doesn't know that much more than me. He knows a little bit more than me. He doesn't know that much more than me. But if you won't have a rabbi, then you're not well off. So they say, take someone, even someone who doesn't know that much more than you. If you have no one better, make him the rabbi. Honor him, treat him like a rabbi. You're better off to have someone to look up to than to be in a situation where you say, well, he doesn't know that much more than me. No, make him into the rabbi. And the Torah tells us here the same thing. Make him into your king. Treat him like a king. Give him that honor, and then he'll be the king. You have to give it to him. Yeah?
There's a king is also a rabbi, right? So does the king has to get up for his rabbi, and his rabbi does he have to get up for the king?
So there's a duality. In private, the king has to show honor to the rabbi, or to the prophet, not the rabbi. The king has to show honor to the Torah. And that's why we see from Chizkiyo HaMelech, when the prophet would come before him, he'd get up and kiss him and bow before him, and he'd give him all the honor in the world. But in public, he demanded that the prophet show him honor, because in public, it's important that everyone sees the respect that's given to the king. There's a duality. On the one hand, on the inside, he has to give honor to the Torah. On the outside, he must have the honor. The only time that the king will stand publicly before someone else is when he comes before the Kohen to ask a question before God. Then he stands before him as though he's the layman, and he asks the question. And the Kohen stands with his back to him and asks the question before God. That's the only time. The Torah tells us we have to establish a king based upon God's say-so. This seems to say that it has to be by the say of a high priest, by the say of a Kohen Gadol, the Urim Betumim, or through a prophet. And that leads us to a question, is there such a mitzvah today? People are talking about establishing a king today. We'll find the Davidic dynasty. Well, it says, that the king will be established based upon God's choice. Doesn't say who. We may not establish a non-Jew over the Jewish people. There has to be, the king has to be Jewish from both his father and his mother. The Torah tells us that a king has to be careful not to have too many horses. It's one of his commandments, so that he won't end us up leading us back to Egypt. And the Torah commands us not to go back in Egypt. And the problem is that we know there were great communities, thriving communities in Egypt. Were they all transgressing? So there's one Rishon that writes that the Rambam always used to sign his letters when he lived in Egypt. He used to sign the letter saying, I am Moshe the son of Maimon, and every day that I live here in Egypt, I am transgressing three biblical commandments. Seeming to indicate you're not allowed to go back to Egypt. The problem is, we'll start quoting the sources. We have a tradition that in Alexandria in Egypt, there was a tremendous population of Jews. They had such a big shul that when they'd make a blessing in the front, the Jews all the way in the back couldn't hear. They'd wave flags telling them this blessing was just said, and everyone would yell out, Amen, Amen. They'd all say Amen, but they couldn't hear them. That's such a huge community out in Alexandria in Egypt. And the Gemara asks, why is it that this community was wiped out by Alexander the Great? The Gemara says they were punished because they transgressed this verse, that you're not supposed to go back to Egypt. That Gemara certainly seems to indicate that this is a biblical prohibition today to go back to Egypt. The question is, Daniel went back to Egypt, and there were great thriving communities and great rabbis who went and lived in Egypt. So there's another Gemara. The Jerusalem Talmud says there are three places that the Torah warns us not to go back in Egypt. That certainly seems to indicate we're not allowed to go back to Egypt. But there's another Gemara. The Gemara tells us that there was a village of big tzaddikim in Egypt, and that village was destroyed. And then Abaye asked his Rebbe, Rav Yosef, who was blind, his big Rebbe, who had a tremendous tradition, he knew so many Mishnayos by heart, Abaye, who was the orphan, orphaned by his father, he asked his Rebbe, Rav Yosef, he asked him, why is it that this city was destroyed? And Rav Yosef answered him, he told him, because as Jerusalem was being destroyed, the people out here in Egypt, as big tzaddikim as they were, they didn't mourn. They said, we're okay. So Gush Katif is destroyed, but I have my home. So missiles are falling out on Netzarim, but I'm okay. Missiles are falling in the north. I'm okay. So why was this city destroyed? Rav Yosef told Abaye, because as Jerusalem was being destroyed, they said, yeah, but I'm okay. They weren't mourning too much. They weren't mourning, and that's why they were destroyed. And the question is, why didn't Rav Yosef give the same answer that the other Gemara gave about Alexandria? Why didn't Rav Yosef tell him they were destroyed because they lived in Egypt, and God said, don't live in Egypt. And from here, some want to say that this Gemara, Rav Yosef disagrees. Rav Yosef is of the opinion that one may live in Egypt, and that's why they say, we find that Daniel lived in Egypt, and great rabbis and great communities lived in Egypt. Others want to say that the prohibition is to go from Israel to Egypt. But from any other land, Egypt is okay. God said, I don't want you to retrace your steps back to Egypt, meaning retrace from Israel back to Egypt. But if I'm living out in Germany and I want to live in Egypt, that's okay. That's a very dominant opinion among the Rishonim. So anyone that's wondering halacha what to do should ask his rabbi.
So do Jews are permitted to go to see the pyramids?
Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. The Medrash tells us that when we have mitzvahs in the Torah, God doesn't tell us why He commanded us these mitzvahs. We can't do halacha in this class. We're familiarizing ourselves with.
To see or not at all.
Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. When we read the Torah doesn't tell us why we have commandments. Some are logical, but many we don't know why. We're not allowed to eat meat with milk. Why not? We're not allowed to wear shatnez, wool and linen together. Why not? We're not allowed to do work on the Sabbath. So the Torah tells us a certain aspect of why, but we don't know why. God says, if I'll tell you why, you'll think you know better. There was one mitzvah in the Torah that I explained why. I said, don't have too much money, because you'll be too haughty. A king shouldn't have too much money, he'll be too haughty. He shouldn't have too many wives, because they'll misguide him. He shouldn't have too many horses, because it'll lead him back to Egypt. One aspect, one mitzvah, these mitzvahs that revolve around the king, I revealed why. And what happened? The wisest man of all, King Solomon, said, oh, I know why. So if that's the whole reason, so I'll have a lot of money and I won't be haughty. I'll have a lot of horses and I won't end up going to Egypt. I'll have a lot of wives and I won't let them steer my heart away. And he messed up on all three. He ended up sending people back to Egypt. He ended up being too haughty. And he ended up having with his wives mislead him. That's what the prophet says. So obviously, King Solomon, on his level, it's not us on our level. But on his level, he erred. And here God says, look, the wisest man, when he heard, he understood the reasoning behind mitzvahs, he thought he could do better than the Torah. And that's why I can't reveal to you the reasons of the Torah, because you'll always think you could do better. If I tell you meat and milk is for health, so you'll say, oh, I'm okay. I didn't say it's for health. I'm just giving an example. Just like King Solomon thought he could out...
Many secular Jews think so, even though it's not true.
No. Okay.
No, I'm saying
it's not for health, but it's definitely more healthy than eating milk.
That's another discussion.
Spiritually, not eating milk and milk and meat together is not.
The Torah tells us. The Torah tells us that the king has his job is to take a Torah from before the Kohanim, copy it over, and have his own Torah that goes with him wherever he goes. The king used to have a very small Torah that went with him wherever he went. Now the question is, why does he have to go copy it from the Torah before the Kohanim? We have a tradition that there was Sefer Ezra, Sefer HaAzara. There was a Sefer Torah that was maintained in the Azara, in the courtyard of the temple, that was supposed to be the most exact Sefer Torah. Whenever they'd have a question, what's the tradition supposed to be? Is it supposed to be spelled like this or like that? They'd go there and check it. So here we seem to have a source for this concept that shows up definitely in the Second Temple and according to some in the First Temple as well. Some want to say it's Sefer Ezra, the book that Ezra wrote. So his book remained. But others want to say that it existed in the First Temple because we see they found the scroll, so to speak, in the time of Yoshio. That's a long, separate discussion. Yeah, Daniel.
I was wondering if the Jewish kings had a kind of crown, a special head covering.
What do you mean? They had a crown. Sure, they had a crown.
They had a crown?
Not only did they have a crown, but the Gemara says that the crown was fashioned in a way that it only fit on someone's head who came from David's home. There was something in the crown that made it not... David's head was misshaped, but it had a shape that was different than everyone else's, and his offspring had that shape, and if you came from David's home, you could wear the crown. If you didn't, you couldn't wear the crown, wouldn't fit on your head.
Well, when somebody was born with David's home, his head was straight.
What? I don't know.
Do you think that is shape? So you make him
the Torah tells us that if the king fulfills the Torah the way he should, he'll live a long life. And now the king needs this blessing because we have a tradition, Rabbanut mekabelet et be'aleh. Once one has a position of authority, it causes him to die younger. And that's why whenever a king is appointed, everyone yells out, Yechi HaMelech, long live the king, as it says in Melachim, that when King Solomon was appointed as king at age 12, so everyone yells out, long live the king. He's 12 years old. What are you telling him? Yeah, because once he's appointed king, then our tradition is he'll die younger. The second a person is appointed to leadership, it causes him to lose years from his life. Yosef died before all his siblings. Why? Because he was king.
He lived 110 years. It's also.
And everyone else outlived him. All his brothers outlived him.
Vayamot
Yosef, v'chol echav. Yosef, and then all his brothers, and then everyone else. Yeah, what'd you say, man? Okay, so the Torah says a special promise, that if the leader keeps the Torah the way he should, God says, I promise, I'll lengthen his days.
So we expect for kids that they don't keep the law as they should?
Yeah.
They should live a long time?
No.
Oh.
They don't keep the laws, no. The Torah tells us he will be king and his offsprings will be king. And from here we learn that positions of leadership pass on from a person to his son. And this applies not only to leadership, it's many positions. If a person was a rabbi and he has a son that can be a rabbi, his son has first rights to be a rabbi. If a person is a chazan and he has a son that's a chazan, his son has first rights to be chazan. This applies to many, many things. God says the tribe of Levi won't have a portion in the land. I am their portion. Levi is the 10th son if you count from the end going up, and that's why he's Meiser. He's the 10th that God says is my portion. The Kohanim get in our parasha the gifts of the arm, the cheek, and part of the intestines. This corresponds to the arm with which Pinchas took the spear, the cheek with which Pinchas stood in prayer before God, and the intestines that Pinchas stuck the spear through the woman's intestines. These are all the first. When an animal walks, the cheek, the face is the first thing that leads it, and the arm is the first limb that goes out before it, and the part of the intestines that's given to the Kohanim is also the first part when you analyze the intestines.
They eat kishkes?
They eat kishkes. And these gifts are given to the Kohanim. Again, the concept that Torah teaches us, take the first things and give them to God or God's representatives. These gifts are all chulin. A Kohen could do whatever he wants with them. He could give them to Yisrael. He could sell them. He could do whatever he wants.
So if he doesn't want to eat it, he can give it away to
He could give it, or he could sell it. He could do whatever he wants. These gifts are chulin.
The sacrifice is made, he has to eat it.
The sacrifice is something else. We're not discussing sacrifices. We're talking about when you have a regular animal. You want to cut up a cow. Guys want me to bring in an animal, right? We'll cut up that cow. Well, four parts of that cow are supposed to be given to the Kohen. And that when the Kohen gets it, it remains chulin. The Torah tells us that the Kohen stands in service, and from here we derive that all service was done standing. And from here we also derive that prayer has to be done standing. And leaning is equivalent to sitting. So one has to remain standing and not lean on something. If you're on a bus that's wobbly and you're holding on, well, every time you're leaning, it's as though you're sitting.
Leaning on what?
On anything. So long as you're not supported by your feet, it's the equivalent of sitting. And we're going to pause here. Maybe we'll continue tomorrow night. I want to make a suggestion.